Last year, he was our most regular guest on Sunday morning. This year, thankfully, he hasn't been. No offence at all intended. He commanded a good proportion of broadcasting time in 2020 when COVID was sending us into higher levels, and he became a member of the New Zealand Order of Merit in the New Year's Honours and received the Prime Minister's Science Communication Prize. We still look for good reasons to chat with epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker from the University of Otago, and we've found two or three. Morena, Michael.
Morena, Jim.
Congratulations on that Science Communication Award, because we haven't talked since, I think.
That's right. Well, thank you. And it's very good to be back with you and your listeners.
Thank you for that, too. Well, a lot to talk about. With the head of a Japanese doctors' union saying that holding the Olympic Games in Tokyo could lead to the emergence of an Olympic coronavirus strain, what's your opinion, can I ask, of them going ahead, the Games?
Well, I have the same view as I think most public health and workers in the medical community, is that staging the Olympics now is a very bad idea for obvious reasons. I mean, they require a huge amount of international travel and mass gatherings, and these are the opposite of what we need to be doing during a pandemic. I know last year they were postponed when the pandemic was less intense globally and in Japan, and arguably the situation is now much worse. Particularly in Japan, which now has is battling its fourth major wave. It's got more infectious variants. There was an article that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it just pointed out how poor their preparations are to protect the athletes and the teams in Japan. I mean, they've got no border quarantine. The athletes will be staying three to a room, apparently. Vaccination's not required. I mean, I feel very sorry for the athletes, who I know have trained so hard for this event, but I think it's the right thing to do.
Well, the deal seems to have been done and they appear at this stage to be determined, so it's very interesting to hear you say that. Stat News Online, the medicine and science website for people who haven't been on it, has had the idea of asking various medical scientists and epidemiologists for their predictions on when this pandemic will end, Michael, and of course we have you. It's been a year and a half of COVID-19. Are we halfway through this thing? What do you think?
Yes, well, I think the answer depends very much on who the we is in this and also what the end of the pandemic actually looks like. If we look at vaccine, for example, as the main pathway out, and if we assume that we need to reach 60 or 70% coverage, the global coverage, when I looked on our world and data, is standing at about 10% who've received at least one dose of vaccine. At the moment, we're looking at 1.7% in Africa and 5.5% in Asia. The good news is that in those countries that have got high coverage, and I think the US is approaching 50%, in the UK about 57%, of people who've had at least one dose of vaccine, we are seeing cases dropping and deaths dropping very markedly. For New Zealand and Australia, we are obviously further behind, but we're looking at getting similarly high coverage by the end of this year or early next year. So in many ways, the pandemic intensity will drop. Unfortunately, it's still so unequal.
Experts are disagreeing. Maria van Kerkhove, the World Health Organization's leading coronavirus expert, apparently, she thought we'd be out of the acute phase by now, and that we could be if the rest of the world had imitated New Zealand. But most scientists, Michael's asked, see attenuation and the virus becoming part of our winter lives, just like the common cold.
Yes, I mean, I think that is one scenario. Other coronaviruses have jumped the species barrier from animals to humans, and they're responsible for the current four coronaviruses that cause, 20 to 30% of the common cold is caused by those viruses. So that's one scenario, that over time we reach an equilibrium with these viruses. And a lot of that equilibrium may not be because the virus is attenuated at all. It may be just that most of us have seen the virus before, particularly as young children. So we've got long-term, at least partial immunity. So it doesn't cause serious illness. So this is one of the scenarios, but we can't guarantee that. And if we look at diseases like smallpox and polio, measles, rubella, we don't want to rely on you just being exposed to this infection as a child. We actually use vaccines to eliminate transmission, and we have elimination goals, or have achieved elimination in the case of smallpox. And I do agree with the WHO scientist here, that actually we shouldn't just rely on vaccines and a view that we will be able to live with coronavirus in the future. It may be that endemic infection is not the best approach. It may be better to think about what New Zealand is doing, and that is the idea of progressive elimination. It does depend on the future trajectory of the virus, because if it becomes just like the other four coronaviruses that cause the common cold, yes, that's the logical end point. But actually, many scientists are also pointing out that that may not be the case. And if we think about the other coronaviruses that cause serious illness, SARS and MERS, they have a high mortality rate. So we can't guarantee that this will turn out to be a mild infection that we can happily live with. The other thing is that it's constantly evolving, and we don't know if some of the variants may also be viruses that we wouldn't want to live with. And we're not sure about the level of long-term effects, the long COVID syndrome, how common that will be. So we might decide, just as we have with other diseases, that the vaccines are so effective and the effects of trying to live with this virus are so severe that we might choose to eliminate it. So I actually don't think that anyone has enough knowledge at the moment to decide on the optimal long-term approach.
Interesting you say that, because historian John Barry, who wrote the definitive account apparently of the Spanish flu, sees differences this time. He says COVID is influenza in very slow motion. The incubation period's unusually long. People are sicker for longer, they're infectious for longer, and a different pathogen is revealing a different pattern. Do you concur?
Yes. And it's not always totally predictable. In fact, many of the problems with how the world's managed the pandemic came from the assumption that it would behave like influenza. And we're just seeing that interesting testimony coming out of the UK now about how the consensus there was that herd immunity was the preferred strategy for the UK early on. And that turned out to be a disastrous miscalculation with this particular virus. And so because of the longer incubation period we see with this virus, 5 to 6 days compared with influenza, which is 1 to 2 days, and also the impact of all of these control measures that are being rolled out around the globe, we're seeing a very slow-moving pandemic wave, or multiple waves crossing the planet. And that's creating a very different threat from influenza.
The jury has been in on Sweden for a while, I think. Pretty much exactly at this time last year, Michael, Professor Johan Giesecke in Sweden said on our program that we'll know who had the right strategy in a year's time, ours or Michael Baker's. But something odd is happening in Sweden. For the first time in 2021, Sweden's rate of coronavirus cases has topped European figures, which is not good for them. But associated deaths are among the lowest. What do you think is going on here? Or there?
Yes, well, firstly, it's quite hard to compare data across countries, and particularly case data, because the number of cases you detect depends very much on how much testing you do. And Sweden did very little testing early on and is doing a lot more now. But I've just looked at the numbers up to today of cases and deaths, and really it's showing that the overall mortality risk is very similar in Sweden to the other Nordic countries and New Zealand in terms of what we call the case fatality risk. That's your risk of dying if you're recorded as a case. And it's all hovering around the 1% mark wherever you are. Where the differences are very marked is that Sweden has had a much more intense pandemic than Finland, Norway and Denmark. And the risk of dying from this infection is 4 to 10 times higher in Sweden compared with those other Nordic countries. So I think that's the key comparison. And of course, the difference with New Zealand is vast. Our death rate of 5 per million versus a Swedish death rate of more than 1,420 per million. So 0.14% of the population of Sweden has died as a result of the pandemic. And if we'd had that same rate in New Zealand, that would have meant over 7,000 New Zealanders would have died by now.
I know you have a collegial professional relationship with Professor Johan Giesecke, but there'd be no doubt in your mind about who won that wager, not that there was any money on it.
Yeah, well, I think In terms of reducing the health impact, there's no question that elimination is the preferred strategy. It also appears to be better for the economy because it means that, and also people's ability to resume their lives, as we've seen in New Zealand.
Just quickly, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the US's leading expert in infectious diseases, as many of us know, says he's now not convinced that COVID developed naturally, and Joe Biden has set up this new inquiry. And US intelligence reckons three Wuhan lab researchers were hospitalized in November 2019 with suspicious symptoms. Are you similarly now in two minds here?
Yes, well, look, I think this is a fascinating development. This new information does make the laboratory escape theory much more likely. It's still not the what you'd say is the default option. And when you think about how things like SARS or other coronaviruses like SARS and MERS emerged, they clearly did cross from animal reservoirs to humans in what are called these spillover events. So I think it's always been the preferred default option for how COVID-19 emerged. So you'd have to have very good evidence suggesting an alternative path to that. At this stage, I think we have to have an open mind about the source of this pandemic.
Speaking of animals to humans, or in this case, vice versa, we know that COVID can be passed from us into animals, i.e., the minks in Denmark. And the worry is that an energized mutation might re-emerge from animals back into us, resistant to the vaccines. And researchers at Duke University say that in Malaysia, hospitalized patients with suspected pneumonia were found to be infected with a new coronavirus picked up from dogs. Would scientists, I'm presuming, be disturbed by this, Michael?
Yes, I think any examples of new viruses crossing from animals into humans is cause for concern. But these events are likely to be very common, partly because there are so many humans on the planet and we've intruded into so many ecosystems and we set up so many what we call monocultures of animals, which create conditions where viruses can circulate and mix and cross species barriers very easily. So I'm sure the more we look, the more we will find these examples. And there are quite literally thousands of coronaviruses that are widespread in animals and birds. And in fact, these are very well known as a problem for veterinary health, and there are already vaccines for preventing these illnesses in animals and birds. So it is not at all surprising that we see examples of transmission from those reservoirs to humans. The good news, of course, is that most of the time humans are what are called dead-end hosts because we don't have the ability to transmit the virus any further, and the virus is not adapted for transmission from us. So that's usually what protects us from a pandemic in these circumstances. But certainly we have to obviously keep an eye on these potential sources of new viruses for humans.
With our intrusions into other ecosystems, the talk we used to hear about this pandemic auguring future pandemics may be right. In other words, we are seeing now what we're going to see again in the not too distant future, do you think?
Yes, I mean, this pandemic has so many lessons for us, and we just need to keep investing in our ability to do this. And I think this is where you may have seen the recent report of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response that was co-chaired by Helen Clark. And that really had a huge number of, I think, really important recommendations for how we have to build up our global capacity. Particularly, we need a highly functional World Health Organization because that's really the only way we can get this sort of multilateral engagement in every corner of the globe to actually allow us to detect these outbreaks really early and manage them.
Professor Michael Baker, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks again, Jim. Great to be here.